Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organizational studies, brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is episode 46, which features a live recording from a professional development workshop on classics in organizational and management theory, held at the 78th annual meeting of the Academy of Management in Chicago. To learn more about the event, please visit our new website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This workshop was intended to raise interest towards classic authors and ideas in the field of organization and management theory. So, it echoes the goal of our podcast to disseminate ideas about organizational theory with a special focus on the classics. The rationale for the workshop is that our field, although relatively young, seems sometimes more attentive to disruptions than continuities, novelty instead of tradition. So we hope too that the workshop would help making us more aware regarding connections between earlier and current scholarship, and enable us to explore how ideas, concepts, approaches from the classics, broadly understood, might better equip us to understand current affairs. The workshop included four senior scholars, and each one of them presented about the work of an author they believe is important for organization and management theory. The audience was made up of participants from the Academy of Management annual meeting. We were oversubscribed this year, so apologies for those who could not be included in the event. The good news is that you can now listen to the presentations from the workshop. Also, we are already planning the next year's workshop for the Academy of Management 2019, in which we hope to accommodate a larger crowd, and that workshop will probably focus on contingent theory, so stay tuned for news about that. The first speaker was Paul Adler, who is professor of management and organization and sociology and environmental studies at the University of Southern California. Paul focused on the work of Karl Marx, an author that needs little introduction, and who was one of the most important social scientists in history, and lived between 1818 and 1883. So, if he was still alive, he would be celebrating his birthday of 200 years this year.
All right, what a treat it is to get to talk with you all today about Marx and to hear these other presentations about such other interesting speakers. Let me just begin by stepping back and talking a little bit about why bother with these classic authors. So some of you might have come across this utterance from Alfred North Whitehead, "A science which to forget its founders is lost." A lot of our colleagues, I think, love this idea. I think it's stupid. I think the social sciences are deeply committed to renewing their engagement with the classics for a variety of reasons. I love this essay by Jeffrey Alexander. I encourage you to go look it up. Basically, social sciences can't avoid these value-laden debates, unlike the natural sciences. And as a result, in our field, paradigm conflict is endemic. It's not like we move successively from Newtonian physics to Einsteinian physics. All these paradigms are in our orbit, there's our intellectual orbit. And to that extent, social sciences, it seems to me, lie somewhere between the natural sciences and the pure humanities in the relative importance of current work vis-a-vis older work. We need to be paying attention to both the older classics and the more current stuff. The classics in our field, in social sciences, serve as shorthand signifiers of whole constellations of thought, which have proven their enduring fruitfulness, and also an inspiration for us. When you go back and read, whether it's Mary Douglas or Albert Hirschman or Mary Parker Follett or Karl Marx, once you've made your way past the superficial differences in vocabulary associated with the different time periods in which they were writing, all of a sudden you discover all the things we're talking about today, they were already actual in their minds at the time. There's some elements, obviously, that have disappeared in history, but a lot of it is incredibly relevant. So I encourage you to dig into it. It was that inspiration that led me to edit this book a few years back on sociology and organization studies, the classical foundations. We have a lot of really terrific people writing articles about all these wonderful authors in our earlier history, pre-World War II history, or for the main part, pre-World War II history. And then Oxford, being Oxford, they couldn't resist adding a second volume where we went to the more contemporary period. We moved away from classics, and so here you've got a whole slew of more contemporary writers too. But some of these people are 50 years old, so for most of you in the room, they may as well be classics too. So. Why Marx? I would say why Marx, because today a lot of the central ideas in Marx's analysis seem rather relevant. Marx's basic story, I think, you could summarize fairly straightforwardly. Capitalism is not the last series in the forms of society that humanity is likely to witness. God help us if it's the best humanity can do for itself. We've seen other forms of society in history, and the chances are pretty good that there'll be something superior to capitalism that comes along sooner or later. But the failures of capitalism seem all too obvious. In many ways, it seems like the new technologies are simply stretching the boundaries of what's possible given the constraints of capitalist relations of production, capitalist ownership, the property relations, the market process, the multiplication of failures, whether they're social, environmental, or economic, or political, seems all too obvious to the naked eye. And lots of people seem to see out there through the mists of their fantasies and delusions, perhaps, or through their rose-colored glasses, or just looking microscopically at all sorts of interesting, innovative organizational forms that seem to suggest a successor system to capitalism. So we've got some ideas about what that socialistic system that might succeed capitalism looks like. And indeed, some sense that there are social forces out there that might one day carry us forward rather than backwards in a society's evolution. That said, Marx is a difficult author for us to deal with. Multifaceted in his poetry, right? So we've got economics, we've got philosophy, we've got history. In the world of academia in which we live, that degree of interdisciplinarity is uncomfortable, it's jarring. You're not sure that you can pick up Marx's sociologist without also somehow immersing yourself in the history and the politics and the philosophy. That makes it difficult. Plus, it's expressed in a Hegelian idiom, which some people love, and once you get used to it, feels very liberating. But boy, until you get comfortable with it, it just sounds like gibberish and obfuscation. So that's not easy to deal with. And interestingly, whether it's in our graduate programs, in sociology, let alone economics or political science, people get very little exposure to Marx, certainly in management studies. Very few people in their graduate studies have had any exposure to this literature. All the organized political forces that used to have, you know, if you joined the German Social Democratic Party or at least its youth wing in the old days, you would be in a study group studying Capital, Volume 1, 2, and 3, until you worked your way through this and understood enough about the foundations of all these ideas in social democracy. Radical left-wing movements, there were more social democratic movements, many of them claimed lineage in Marx, and there was a whole community of people who were brought up with this complex Marxist terminology and ideas. That's all disappeared, and so those of us who care about Marx sometimes feel like we're in a little chapel in the cave, holding a little candle aflame for some saint, hoping that one day people will rediscover his relevance. But I persist anyway. And I persist because I think that when you read Marx, you see a very fruitful framing of a lot of issues that are very germane in the life of us as consumers, as workers, and we look at the lives of managers that we study. The products that, I should back up one second. What makes Marx interesting, I think, from a management point of view, is that he has this sort of two layers of analysis going on. On the one hand, he has a trans-historical, anthropological understanding of the labor process. On the other hand, he says that labor process takes a distinctive form in each of these different historical epochs. In the capitalist period, that labor process takes a very distinctive form in which working, for example, takes the form of wage labor. I'll explain a bit further what I mean by that. The products we produce have these two aspects. The substance of it, if you will, is some utility, some use value that we're providing to people. But the form in which that happens in a capitalist society is as exchange values. It's something we can sell for money. And within the production process, we've got this trans-historical labor process that takes a specific form under capitalism that Marx calls the valorization process. Let me give you a picture of that. The labor process, Marx says, go back as far as you want in history. What you'll discover in human activity is a fundamental structure where people doing stuff try to work on some object to transform it into something that they find useful, necessary, valuable, mediated in that work by tools, and by some division of labor, some collective to which they belong. Human labor is a collective activity deep into our anthropological history. So that's the trans-historical, anthropological view, if you will. And Marx says under capitalism, this is overlain by, right, a distinctive historical form in which creative labor takes the form of wage bills, a variable capital that the capitalist is constantly trying to reduce. The collective work that takes the form of a bureaucratic or other kind of command structure where people exchange their creative ability to work for,
wage and submitted themselves to the authority of the boss. What we anthropologically, what is presented to us as tools, take the form for the in the capitalist enterprise as constant capital, as invested in equipment and tools that have to be depreciated, that have to be accounted for, that we constantly try to minimize expenditures on. And as I said, the product has this two-sided nature. These two sides, Marx says, picking up on Hegelian idea that takes you a little bit into weird territory, the form is in contradiction with the substance, that there's tension between the two. These two aspects presuppose each other, but they also oppose each other. This is Hegelian dialectical book, blah, blah, blah. But it's when you get used to it, it's a productive, it's a fruitful way of thinking about things, that there's some tension here between the capitalist treatment of work and the creative demands of workers and indeed of firms too. For the need for creativity. And across all of these elements, we've got these interesting tensions. I think this is a helpful frame. I would say, to go back a step in the story, a lot of organization theory has sought universal theories of organization that would apply to organization under any socioeconomic system without being very attentive to the specific form of organization production under capitalism. We then have a bunch of people who want to take those universalistic precepts. Growing size means growing specialization. Growing size means growing standardization. We have these generic rules of organization design. Some people want to take those universalistic rules, which belong in this sort of anthropology of organization, and then say, oh, but they may be different in China as compared to the US or Portugal as compared to Sweden. Fine. I would say, on the one hand, we're zooming too far out to anthropology. On the other hand, we're zooming too far in to these cultural differences. There's value in all of these different points on the zoom, right? But there's an intermediate zoom frame which brings into focus capitalism, the distinctive forms of capitalist organization. Right? And Marx, I think, helps us understand how to think about the form of the production process that's distinctive to this capitalist form of society in which we live and which seems to be making us so different. So that gets you this far. And I think that's fruitful because it captures, I think, I've always found this a very, very easy to talk to managers about these tensions. They live these tensions every day, right? We're trying to produce something for our customers, but the cost pressure is killing us. We have to strip out some of the more expensive features to our product. And then our customers get angry. We're torn between the use value and exchange value of what we're producing. We want our workers to be creative, engaged, and so forth. But we had to lay a bunch off last month, and that kind of hit morale. So, we have to force them to adopt these new new guidelines that structure what they work in ways that they don't really like. So that all of these tensions I find very experientially, phenomenologically relevant in the life of the capitalist enterprise. So I found Marx a very fruitful frame for talking to managers about the work, but indeed in the classroom, for that matter, for talking to future managers about what life is like in this contradictory enterprise, which is capitalism. I'd say a couple more things. Marxism also gives you a terrific frame for thinking about not just the production process, but the social reproduction process. Marx, very similar to Polanyi. Polanyi took much of his inspiration from Marx in this respect. The three fictitious commodities of Polanyi are discussed at great length in Marx. Polanyi's analysis of them is drawn deeply from Marx. Capitalist production process depends on the reproduction of workers through the family and through domestic activity. It depends on natural preconditions for natural resources. Right? It depends on this externality called the state, and you might remember Polanyi talks about money as a fictitious commodity. These are all fictitious commodities, unlike the commodities produced here, which are real commodities. The argument is they're not real commodities for various reasons, which are Marxist reasons. They're not produced for sale on the market. They're just preconditions. And Marx's theory gives you a lovely way of talking about the contradictory relation between the sphere of production on the one hand and the sphere of reproduction on the other. Nancy Fraser has a bunch of really terrific essays on social reproduction theory where she sort of integrates feminist theory and Marxist theory in a terrifically robust way. I find very fruitful and compelling. For those of us who are interested in the impacts of work on family life or in the environmental crisis, or firms, political engagement, and the corruption of political processes, I think is a pretty fruitful way of thinking about it. Two last thoughts, then. A lot of people get deterred by fake news. There's some fake problems, I think. There's a lot of people think that Marxism has these little impasses. I'm sure there's many problems with Marxist theory, but these are not amongst them. There's plenty of room for agency in Marxist theory. Marx's 18th Brumaire quip that men make their own history. People make their own history, but under circumstances they don't choose themselves. That's the whole structuration theory right there in a nutshell. There isn't much more to be said about the problem with agency. As I see, inhabited institutions picks up that exact same idea, I think, quite definitely correct, if I'm wrong. Do ideas affect your sleep? Well, blah, yeah, of course they do. Marx doesn't deny that. Some of you are worried about the transformation problem. Hands up if you're worried about it. No, okay, I'll pass on that. That's easy. Is the labor really a source of all value? Marx says, obviously not. There's many things we draw from nature, from our social interactions, which are very valuable, as use values. Marx is a story. When Marx says labor is a source of all value, he's talking about the source of all exchange value. And that's just a feature of capitalism. The world should be otherwise. And under capitalism, exchange value is the critical variable governing the success of the firm. So at labor time, he argues, is the source of that. That's an interesting point. Do the failures of the USSR prove Marx wrong? I think rather right. There's some fake problems. We can talk more about them. I think there's plenty enough problems in Marxism that we don't get hung up on these fake ones. And I like Marx, or at least my take on Marx, for one other fundamental reason. I think that I've been involved, as some of you know, for a while with critical management studies as a current of work within the academy. I love the critical edge of critical management studies. I think capitalism sucks, and the sooner we're done with it, the better. But it seems to me the critique of capitalism is going to sound like a shrill polemic unless somehow we fold into that critique a recognition of the kind of progress that capitalism has wrought relative to the pre-capitalist systems that people still live under in many parts of the world and have lived under elsewhere too. So that I think Marx, in his own writings, you'll discover a very rich appreciation of the progress represented by capitalism relative to pre-capitalism, and indeed the progress wrought by capitalism as it develops. That progressive side of capitalism is celebrated quite explicitly and eloquently by Marx and integrated into his critique. So I think that, for me, makes Marx a rather compelling start point of departure for management studies and indeed for critical management studies. With that, my time is up. Thank you.
The second speaker was Silva Dorado, who is an associate professor of management at the University of Rhode Island. Silva talked about Albert Hirschman, an important economist and prolific author who lived between 1915 and 2012.
Hi, everybody. So I'm going to be talking about Albert Hirschman, and Albert Hirschman is probably not in the Oxford book. Albert Hirschman tends to be a political economist and was better known as an economist, and I don't think he has got enough attention in the management literature, which is probably the reason that when Pedro asked me, what author would you want to talk about, I said Albert Hirschman. One of the reasons I also am very interested in Albert Hirschman, my dissertation was in Bolivia. In the management literature, the classics that I was studying in my PhD program, was not particularly helpful to think about Bolivia. It was a big exercise to create a bridge. And I'm always amazed a little bit on the boundaries that we create for ourselves, having scholars in other fields, such as Albert Hirschman, whose original work came from Colombia and came from developing countries, and that we could actually be building on, and the bridge will be much easier because he was educated on the social theories. You know, he was educated in Marx, he was educated in Weber, so he actually did some of that legwork for us. So particularly now that I think in organization studies and in management, we are exploring, many more of us are actually exploring questions in developing countries, that is really time to capture the richness of the ideas that Hirschman brought. So these are some of his best-known works. It seems like everybody knows Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. If you haven't read it and you're about to cite it, it's a tiny little book. It began as a little paper that then he expanded. And he's such a beautiful writer that it is a book that you can read on a Saturday, okay? So that's an amazing book. The Passion and the Interest is a historical essay going from Aristotle's to, you know, modern thinkers. And so it's a beautiful trip. Again, an amazing writer. giving you a mix of history with ideas. So a wonderful read that I actually read well before I was in academia on a summer, and it's a really nice read. His earlier trilogy is a little more of work because they come from economics, but it's really the work that is more grounded and more helpful for people interested in doing research in developing countries. And then he has a really long bibliography, a plurality of essays. He's very well known for this, A Bias for Hope, and then this propensity of self-subversion, which he was actually to rethink and retool everything that he had offered to the literature, because he was always a self-critic. This is my version of it, and I think I wanted to do this, or I did this tiny little graph, which probably doesn't do as much justice to his thinking as it should, because in a way, we could put management there. Okay. So you have a strategy on the left with economics. You have organization studies, because I put political science there, it's more loyal to Fishman. But sociology will fit very well there. And social psychology, which is organizational behavior. So he is actually a scholar who was building and on a regular basis connecting these three fields, which are very familiar to us. And his focus was on change, organizational change, system change, society change. That was all his quest, and I think I can say that with a lot of confidence. Economics was his playground. He was interested fundamentally in economic development and inequality. So that's sort of the what. The who, he was fundamentally thinking about bureaucrats. And I particularly has always found it inspirational, because if you do work on development, you don't want to go around and say to people, well, you want microfinance, why don't you get Mohamed Yunus? Okay? If we just had enough Mohamed Yunus to go around, the world will be a better place. We have these histories full of heroes, and it's just not very useful to think about bringing change to the world in terms of heroes, because heroes are great, Mohamed Yunus is great, but you cannot replicate Mohamed Yunus. So, Hirschman was always far more interested in how that bureaucrat in this province in Colombia can actually engage and bring change. He was much more interested in everyday people and thinking about that specific question. So his who is the everyday person. That's the people that he's thinking. He drew particularly for Festinger in Stanford Social Psychology. And he was very interested in how can people get uncomfortable? Uncomfortable enough to actually bring change. And that's where he draws from social psychology. And he had a love affair with France, even though he's from German origin, and he actually studied in Italy. So his intellectual life, academic life was in France, and he would always talk about his ideas as petite ideas. And we also have to put him in the context that he was coming behind Marx, and these were big ideas. And he was far more interested in the petite idea. How can I have a petite idea that can be useful for the bureaucrat in this municipality doing this specific work? This is how he saw himself in relation to Marxism. So the historical theory that he's writing, this is in the late 50s, the 1960s. We are having a lot of questioning, the movements of the late 1960s. Okay, and so he's receiving a lot of backlash from the new voices in academia, which are actually Marxist voices. And this is his response to them. What am I? What is my academia? My academia is in increasing the number of options. There has to be a space between neoliberal economics and Marxist economics. And this is the space where I want to operate. I don't want to have a complete, free liberal economics, and I don't want to have a revolutionary changing of capitalism. There has to be intermediate solutions. So I'm just going to have my petite ideas, and I'm going to work within this space. So the first three books, which he wrote, they're very connected. He didn't think about it as a trilogy initially, but every time he will write a book, he will have these ideas that either further exploring. And so it finished being a trilogy, and the three of them are very connected. So I'm going to spend some time here because this tends to be the area that is least familiar to people. Okay. So the way he operates and the way he writes his books is this a bit of a departure, no? a thesis that he's holding on his head. And the thesis in this trilogy was this fracassomania. So fracassomania is you think that you're gonna fail. Okay? So he has this idea of unbalanced development. We're coming from the Marshall Plan in Europe. Okay? It was like a big investment in Europe, and everything is going to move from there. So can we apply the Marshall Plan to developing countries? Well, it's not that clear. What's going on? What are the faults? Okay? So he says, our investigation, our meaning his ideas, holds that if only we can remove or neutralize our difficulty, then all other bottlenecks, serious as they may be, will go away. He's not talking about the needed factors. He's not talking about capital or labor. Our diagnosis is simply that countries fail to take advantage of their development potential because, for reasons largely related to the image of change. So we're going back to social psychology. It has to do with these individuals and the specific way that they see what they can change and where to go when they're changing. So how can he change this? What is going to be the petit idée? And he has several. Okay, I'm just introducing you to a couple of them. So one of them is increased awareness. And he gets this idea from his observations. He's absolutely grounded. All what he does, even though he's an economist, is case studies. Okay? And he's traveled widely in developing countries, and he wonders, how is it that we can trust a developing country airline, that they're very safe, they're as safe as any other airline, but we cannot trust the roads. The roads will have these big holes. Both of them are modes of transportation. Both of them involve engineers. Both of them are for developing countries. How is it that developing countries' planes don't fall, but people die all the time in developing countries' roads? What is the difference between roads and planes? And exploring that idea, he comes with this idea of a narrow latitude for error. What happens when a plane falls? When a plane falls, it's big news. A lot of people die at the same time. It's a huge tragedy. What happens with this traffic accident? People die in a much more slower pace, and you don't get it on the news. So is there any way that we can build on this for my bureaucrat in this province in Colombia to bring about change? Well, we can do this if we actually work on mechanisms to have increased awareness. So he provides the answer. It's like, what about, you know, instead of paving roads with like rocks and gravel, which might be more long-lasting, I should pave them with bituminous pavement, because then it's going to become more visible. Okay? So it's not a big idea. This is not the revolution. We're not fencing with capitalism. But maybe if we think through what is the difference between planes and roads, we can come up with an answer that creates the motivation for actors to act and become engaged. Another petit idée is a hiding hand. So, you know, we all have, you know, hide the invisible hand of the market and, you know, the visible hand of the businesses. These are not those hands, okay? He's going back to social psychology. And the hiding hand is that once you become engaged into doing something, and you actually have to keep doing, you finish being engaged into action in a way that you are much more in a problem-solving mechanism. This is very Carlyle. Okay, if you read the Munchausen's disaster, well, you know, you cannot escape the fire, so you need to do something. So why don't we create a burn area and we stay there, okay? So we humans have this double set of circumstances. You know, on the one hand, we are creative. On the other hand, sometimes we get ourselves into challenges that are beyond what we can do. And once you get yourself into that position, you can actually, you may actually be able, if you cannot escape the situation, to engage in creative ideas. If I can give you an example, maybe some of you know the Irvine Hospital for Cataract Surgery. I could, you know, I don't want to spend a lot of time giving it to you, but that's an example of that. The people that started that cataract surgery, they finished creating a factory of lenses, okay? Which they promised. They were not set up to do it at the very beginning. It only came at the very end. If you would have told the people that built this factory of ocular lenses that they were going to build a factory of ocular lenses when they started this project, they would have said, not in a million years. Not in a million years. They finished doing something that was very revolutionary, but it was because they started on a specific path, and the path drove them to that specific destination. So one of the challenges that we have in management is this lack of temporality of our status. we tend to think on a one-time plane in which, well, I cannot build a factory of ocular lenses because I don't have enough resources in this country. So we're just thinking in one time. What Hirschman is telling you is there is temporality and that the past is pushing you towards the future. And there is not only that specific context, but what you did on the past moves you to what you're going to do. So temporality is much better captured in this idea of the hiding hand. Okay, exit goals and loyalty. I love this sentence. This is how he starts the book. Okay? This is the departure. Okay? So he wonders rhetorically and ironically, how is it that baboon bands have no problem killing their leaders pretty much. So when they have poor leaders, they just, they have a very good system of getting better leaders. Why? Because if not, they will die. And we humans have a much higher tolerance for poor leadership. Much higher tolerance. So why we have this much higher tolerance for poor leadership? And he says, well, it's the nature of society. Society's ability to take considerable deterioration on a stride. We actually have enough resources that allows us to live for a very long time with bad leadership, on a way not realizing that we are getting ourselves into big trouble. So that's the problem. That's the departure. That's where he's coming from. Okay, that's exit voice and loyalty. So the problem here is motivation. Here the actors are able to do this, but they don't have the motivation, okay? It's not the day, okay? We're not going to run out of food. Climate change is going to happen, but it's not going to be tomorrow while we're doing our presentation. So the rest of the book, a lot of it is really an exploration. And I think people have cited it in management because it has helped us understand our organizations, okay? But it's really an exploration. And I'm not going to spend much time there. He's trying to go back to his petit idée. And actually, the book, he got it out very quickly. He was interested in doing all the projects. And if you read it, for me, that's the most interesting part. But it's the less developed. Okay. So what he's trying to figure out is, like, how can we escape this situation? And he goes back to Festinger, and he goes back to the idea of dissonance. And he talks about social dissonance. One example of social dissonance, a wonderful book by a political economist called Peter Evans, Embedded Autonomy, from 1994, gives a great example of the relevance of thinking about this in terms of social dissonance. So social dissonance means that you become a member of a club, and which is very hard for you to become a member, like Cancelle from France, okay? You have a really high barrier of entry. Once you have such a high barrier of entry, what happens? You develop a strong loyalty to that specific group. Okay? And if you become, if you have that connection to a specific group, now even you may completely disagree with who they are, but you're very attached to them. Okay? So Peter Evans has this idea of embedded autonomy, which can really bring in, granovetter idea of embeddedness. With an idea of meritocracy together. So he differentiates between states, thinking on this dissonant loyalty. So what is the difference between Southeast Asian countries and Congo in Africa in terms of the effectiveness of bureaucrats in these countries to bring about economic development? And the difference has to do with the connections these people have. So if in Southeast Asia, he uses the example of Japan, people has very strong personal connections because they have gone to school with these people between businesses and the state. Okay? And there's no separation. Me coming from Spain, one of the reasons Spain came out in this economic development is because we had these people that had, they were a meritocratic system, but they would bring them in the state. And you have that high entrance system. It was very hard to become a bureaucrat. The same thing that it was in Japan. But you had this connection with the people. And by having this connection with the people, so people will have primary education and will be able to get these exams, you create this dual connection. You wouldn't have that in Zaire. In Zaire, what you had is the ruling class replicating themselves and a big separation with the rest of the society. So when you get this big separation is when you get, these kind of like predatory relations in which one part abuses the other part. And which is a big concern for all of us because inequality is growing and we are getting more and more this like circular replications in which the elites are replicating themselves, and you have this separation with the rest of the people. So these are the dissonant connections, connections that then bridge across different groups of people, and thereby you can have the motivation to engage. The passion and the interest, very quickly, so it's an exploration of these three vices and these three ideas. That's a quote from Giambattista Vico. And so the three vices that define humanity are ferocity, avarice, and ambition. And the reason we have capitalism, okay, is because, you know, we are much happier with avarice as a sin. And we can manage avarice as a sin. And so, is the last sentence. So the pursuit of private utility are transformed into a civil order that permits to live in human society. So the reason that we have capitalism is because the pursuit of the private interest is the best. So Hirschman's Petite Idée is much more of a Gideon, Paul Albert, which is talking about it, more of a structuration idea, is that you have this civil order emerges from the pursuit of private utility because it produces more predictability. The fundamental search is for ontological security. And because people like ontological security, we are willing to sacrifice into a number of areas, and we're willing to give the search for private utility the ruling of the world. Just going back, these are some of the petite idées. So you have the idea of the increased awareness, a very situated concept. Okay, can we design things in such a way that we actually get people more engaged? We have this idea of the hiding hand, which is about temporality. You know, coming from the past and going into the future, we're going to be able to engage and bring about change. What is the motivation for change? People living can be a motivation for change. Social movements can create a motivation for change, which is voice. This idea of social dissonance, in which you have connections with unexpected people, and that can create a motivation for change. And then this idea of that one of the driving forces, more than greed being the driving force that will give us a civic society, is actually the search for predictability and security that is the driving force. You want to read first, Worldly Philosopher is a blast, it's a great book. There is a collection of essays, and the essays are short and great, from 2015, and there's a great book full of case studies from 1994, which is a great introduction.
The fourth speaker was Mark Mentreska, who is an associate professor of strategic management in Oxford University Said Business School. Mark explored the work of Mary Douglas, a very important British anthropologist who lived between 1921 and 2007, and who was a colleague of Mark at Oxford for a short time.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead. I want to take a few minutes to talk to you about Mary Douglas today, an anthropologist, social and cultural anthropologist. In some ways, her work is probably the least integrated in kind of contemporary thinking about organizations and management. I think the first three papers and the first three scholars have each really spoken to people who we recognize as who have come to be seen as central and who work with issues both at the very macro level and at the more meso and micro level. I think Mary Douglas is someone I was going to say thank you to all of us. Thanks very much. So to say to all of us, I want to trace out a little bit of her own life, education, work experience. I want to talk through a couple of key works she's done. A few of them are more familiar to people in the management world, the organizations world. Although thinly, I want to give you some comments about her work where we might find interesting questions and issues. And I want to end with a conversation that we'll break into small groups also about what all these people have to say about a theory of organization or helping us understand some of organizations and management. I titled the talk today, For a Theory of Organizations Going Forward with Mary Douglas. I think that's very apt for her own interests. So really quickly, I think many people know this book, How Institutions Think. It's probably the most common among people in our community. It's a set of lectures that were given that were started with a couple of chapters that are a critique of rationality and a critique of rational choice. And then a series of chapters that talk about how institutions do the thinking, how do they do the thinking, how do they classify, how do they forget. So using sort of core tropes from her work, interesting categories in identity, in social mechanisms to both remember and forget, to create identity and to blur identity. So I think this book is important. I put the picture because I think the picture is great, right? It embodies kind of 19th century view of a bureaucratic schoolhouse or a labor farm or a penitentiary, all those interchangeable, and this kind of hydraulic mechanisms, right, with a disembodied head and then a set of hands and some gears. So I think that the photo on the photo on the cover of the book kind of engages people and sort of reminds us of what's to come. Mary Douglas's work, I think, is full of interesting contradictions, much like that of one of her mentors, M.L. Durkheim. But I think it also is fundamentally interested with sort of social organization. I think that's something we want to re-engage with. By the end of the talk, I'm going to ask you to be persuaded that we want to think about social organization again, and specifically we want to think about comparative organization. Her work, I think, distinctive in many ways for many people in many traditions. I think the recurring theme is a unique kind of comparative analysis that spans self and other, that spans levels, that links people and activity and broader organization. And I would say that's something that is somewhat missing from the traditions that we're reporting on here at the Academy of Management and in some other venues. So my plea here is for a renewed kind of comparative analysis. Douglas is a British, born in Britain, and into a very kind of Catholic family, educated in Catholic schools, eventually went to Oxford and studied at St. Anne's as an undergraduate and then later as a graduate student. Her father worked for the British Colonial Office. She worked for the British Colonial Office, where she encountered a lot of social anthropologists. So one of the themes, I think, across all four of these authors, and maybe many interesting authors, is that they had very rich lives. They did lots of things. They were not narrowly academics in the way that some of us are today. They were out in the world. They were engaged with problems in the world, and they tried to make sense of those problems. And I think that Mary Douglas is in that spirit as an anthropologist, but also someone who worked in then the British Colonial Office. And again, lots of complex issues sitting out there. But I want to underscore, just listening to the three other presenters and also thinking about Mary Douglas, these are people who were actively in the world. And that's something that many of us might find interesting to do today, to understand how to think about new kinds of problems that organizations face and also new kinds of challenges that organizations can address. She was educated, as I said, at Oxford, then did field work in the Belgian Congo. That was interrupted. People will be happy about this. Her dissertation got 18 years to finish because it got interrupted by a civil war. And so she sort of forgot about the dissertation, wrote a book on the Lele, one of her early books, and then finished the thesis like 10 years later. So optimism for people like me. Then she spent a long time at University College London, about 22 years, you know, straight on British social anthropologist, influenced by Evans Pritchard, by a number of other people in that tradition. Came to the U.S. At the Russell Sage Foundation, then at Northwestern for a number of years, and then at Princeton, and finally went back to the U.K. in her later years. She was made a fellow of the British Academy, and she got a series of Queen's Honors, Commander of the British Empire, CBE, eventually Dane Commander of the British Empire. I met her, actually, when I was in Oxford first in 2004. We hosted, my colleague Steve Rayner was one of her last students. He was one of her last students at UCL. He wrote a thesis on Maoist and communist splinter groups and factions, and then ended up being a famous climate science policy person. But at Oxford, so we hosted Mary with a group of people, a group of institutional theorists in 2005, and had a chance to visit with her and really a meaningful activity. She passed away a few years later. She then, and I think this is what people, anyone who knew her says this, she was extremely direct and extremely acerbic and had a wry and brutal sense of humor. And so that was kind of an ongoing, part of her kind of careful ethnographic observations was this kind of close and not sparing of fools and also quite direct. The book she wrote, she wrote many other books and many other essays. The ones I think are most central to us probably, and I'm only going to speak to a few of these, are Purity and Danger, an early book, some of you will know, that really tried to understand questions around the duality of purity and danger, the social organization. She wrote a book called Leviticus. These were early studies trying to understand how stigma and how pollution are understood and defined, again, in very pragmatic, applied ways in the everyday lives of people. Natural Symbols. A later book, I think, that also has a following. Two issues there. It's probably her most full exposition, of her idea of grid and group, that is a way to understand individual people, human social people, as located in both grid and group, that is located both in status hierarchies and also in relational ideas. If you follow the network literature, you may know that Harrison White a long time ago sort of expressed his displeasure with the way that institutions and network theorists had sort of parted company, and he coined a term catnet, meaning categories and networks, kind of underscoring the duality of categories and networks. If any of you are following the work, people like John Moore and others, Tim Hannigan and the Academy, you know, these are long-term efforts to understand how people are situated both in category structures and network relationships. And so I think Mary Douglas really deserves some recognition as someone who made that argument very early and very forcefully. Natural Symbols is also an important book for us because I think it talks about how people use recourse to ostensibly natural hierarchies or natural distinctions to justify and legitimate what they do. So, you know, our Weber gave us kind of a studied distinctions on the nature of legitimacy, traditional or bureaucratic or whatever. Mary Douglas says, no, people use recourse to what seem to be natural distinctions, natural divisions of labor, natural hierarchies, and they use those as compelling and powerful ways to authorize and to support various kinds of stratification and prejudice and so forth. So the two books, Period and Danger and Natural Symbols, together were kind of a powerful duo, on one hand giving us a social understanding of pollution and understanding how and why stigma happens, and then locating that in complex micro-social interactions that span both hierarchy and status categories. I think Natural Symbols, some colleagues have picked up on Natural Symbols, that idea of sort of how you legitimate activity. Frank Dobbin and his thesis in the 80s used those ideas. So that, you know, those are ideas that have value, I think, to enrich a kind of the let's call it the dominant Weberian or Marxist views that occur in the Academy. I think, you know, Durkheim is sort of also an under-recognized social theorist for us, mostly dismissed because of his functionalism. I think Mary Douglas is someone who straddled that kind of functionalism with this deeply social and cultural analysis. So again, there's probably some opportunity with Douglas to rehabilitate Durkheim. And of course, that shows up in some institutional work, the interest in rule systems and social rules. Again, more than maybe a resource for us. World of Goods, kind of an early study of consumption with Baron Isherwood, a book, a kind of celebration of her mentor, Evans Pritchard. Risk and Culture, a set of essays shared with Aaron Woldofsky, and same Risk and Blame, books I never read or heard about before I went to the UK. I got to the UK with Steve Rayner, my colleague at Oxford, and there's hundreds of people who identify as cultural theorists, capital C, capital T. I, of course, have never heard of cultural theory in that sense, but it's a huge Douglas world that really engages with policy and is interested in environmental studies, integrated assessment, risk assessment. So her work with Aaron Moldowski, I think, has had a big impact on that community of people who think about risk. Some of you know Mike Power's work and that world on risk. These are kind of complementary worlds, but I'm not going to talk too much, but both Risk and Culture and Risk and Blame really opened up very large communities, particularly in Europe, people interested in policy and very active engagement with policy. That work started with questions around risk, environmental analysis, and so forth. It's a more general interest in policy. We may want to come back to that. You know, we may want to think about, across the Academy, the interest in being engaged in political discourse and public policy issues, the broad move, I think, in the Academy today to do well and to do good, to engage in grand challenges. It may be that Douglas has something to share with us in that conversation on conceptions and categories of risk and impacts to policy. I mentioned How Institutions Think, probably the book people know most about her or identify most about her. She has said, and many other people have said, but she said directly, this is the book I should have written first. So many people say you need to read Mary Douglas in reverse chronological order, that How Institutions Think really gives us the kind of, let's call it the mature understanding of categories, stratification, social mechanisms of change, and that it in some sense should have been the first book in her scholarly product. I have not read Jacob's Tears. I put this here just because a lot of people are interested these days in reconciliation. The communities that have formed around stigma and emotion, I think, are I think what I know about the work, interesting. Again, Jacob's Tears, the priestly work of reconciliation. One of the themes you see clearly in her work, and this I'm going to speak about a little bit, is its embeddedness in her own faith and her and religion broadly and comparative religion. I think it's timely. I'm not particularly religious myself, but I'm happy to say that we want to think about religion as alternative sources of solidarities, alternative understandings of belief systems, rich understandings of why people commit and take on risk and build solidarity that in some ways have been effaced by the modern market. As Paul was saying, you know, Marx told us the market was going to drive out these other kinds of solidarity, and I think today we see, importantly, the renewal of interest in those solidarity. So these are some books I think are, you know, interesting. They're probably the broader canon of her work. Not all of her work, but they help us think. I've gone a little more depth into these four, how institutions think, purity and danger, the kind of natural symbols of this culture. We tried to do it with Camilla Nigmatulina, who I think left. Did she leave? Yeah, she left. Okay, so one of our great doctoral students at Oxford has done a ton of work trying to understand Mary Douglas in citation terms. And so we searched across many different literatures to try to understand Douglas in the social sciences. But we use those four because I think those are really the core that are most relevant for us as organization and management theorists. Just a quick thing. So basically, of all the sites, Mary Douglas, all the sites for Mary Douglas, institutions think about 92.2%, good and danger 0.7%, natural symbols 0.6%, risk and culture 3.9%. Clearly, how institutions think and risk and culture are the larger proportions here. So overall, 3.3%. So not many people cite Mary Douglas, right? Not many people use her work. This is probably the argument for today that these are all, some of the theorists talking about today are well known and talked about, if not used very thoughtfully. Others are not, are talked about not very, used very much. So I put these in just to give us a flavor of where she is. It kind of, one interesting thing, we compiled the sites across time. There's a kind of a resurgence of Mary Douglas' work. You can see these are counts by year, and this is cumulative counts. And so what's interesting here is there's a resurgence in the late 90s, early 2000s, of interest in her work. And we may want to think more about that as we go along. I'm going to just be very brief here. Ian Hacking, some of you know, philosopher of science and statistics, an interesting guy who's written a lot about categories, has a kind of a long set of commentary on Douglas that I will just read because I think they capture what's primary about her for our work. He's talking about how institutions think. I think I opened up that quote I opened up with where a colleague, New Statesman colleague, said, Professor Douglas writes beautifully, lucidly, and polemically. I think that's part of her directness. She is not a one to mince words. Her writing is elegant and beautiful and flows and polemical. If you read her work, it's not neatly worked out. All the pieces aren't put together. It's a bit of an argument and a polemic, and I think that's non-trivial. So he quotes her. He says, Ian Hacking says, she says in the book, How Institutions Think, and this I think is relevant for us. Half of our task is to demonstrate the cognitive process at the foundations of social order. The other half of our task is to demonstrate that the individual's most elementary cognitive process depends on social institutions. She's clearly someone arguing for an embedded, what we would call an embedded view, and this duality between social action, identity, and social understanding. He goes on to say, that's the agenda for chapter 4, 8 pages, he says. But also in generalized, well, that's for the book as a whole, and maybe all of her books, right? So this is the argument that, in some sense, How Institutions Think really captures the core insights of Mary Douglas. The earlier books were also why and how people band together and how they are bonded into social units. That's grid and group banding together and being bonded into social units. The explanations tended to be in terms of practices or rituals of enforced separation, where outsiders are made out as dirty or as dirt to be counteracted by cleansing. He goes on to say, and this is the comparative argument, and this is where I'm going to probably end. Do I have like 1 minute left? So the core for methodological ingenuity, instead of merely choosing an interesting topic, lies in her comparative method. In the first place, we shall not expect to understand religion if we confine ourselves to considering belief only in spiritual beings, however the formula may be refined. He says, rather than stopping to chop definitions, we should try to compare people's views about man, humankind's destiny, and place in the universe. In the second place, we shall not expect to understand other people's ideas of contagion, sacred or secular, until we have confronted our own, right? So it's a very powerful view, and I think this is the gift of Mary Douglas to us today, is this kind of resolutely comparative view, not in terms of levels of analysis, not in terms of units, not the kind of boring stuff that we do typically, right? It's a much more imaginative and critical understanding of comparison. I happened to read a few weeks ago a paper you may know by March Minor and Tammuz, samples, how to use samples of one or less. And they make this point. We often aggregate the outcomes, we should aggregate by observers. Right? It's a very powerful insight. So I think I want you to leave today reflecting on Douglas as a comparativist. These are just more kind of comments from there. And I had a little bit of stuff to say about institutional theory, but I'm going to stop on this slide and say, I think, you know, going forward from Mary Douglas, she joins the other authors that we talked about today. She joins us in an opportunity to really reimagine why we study things, how we study them, comparative method, and a robust kind of commitment to look across existing social units and try to understand what links and organizes.
And that's all for episode 46 from the Professional Development Workshop on Classics in Organizational and Management Theory, held at the 78th Annual Meeting of the Academy of Management in Chicago. Please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com for more information about this event and also to get some additional content, including handouts and pictures from the event. And please join us next week as we discuss organizational identity here on Talking About Organizations.